Welcome back from that big Thanksgiving weekend to Catholic Answers Live. Hope you are well. Hope you enjoyed the visits, if you had visits. I think most people did. I think I read there's like 300 and something million people in America, and 800 million of them traveled during, I think it's 800 million Americans traveled this weekend. I feel like I'm still digesting. Yeah, that could be because we had Thanksgiving dinner again last night. We got invited over to the Staples house, and Valerie cooked a second Thanksgiving dinner. It was awesome. Our number here is 888-318-7884, and we have two wonderful, wonderful guests and two very, very good topics for the next 2 hours with you. A second hour, Dr. Edward Sree is going to be with us, and we're going to talk about the advent of Christ. And you could probably guess why we're going to talk about the advent of Christ right now. This hour, we're going to talk about enculturation. You may have paid a bit of attention to the Amazon Synod. If you did, yes, Nick, I almost said Amazon. Yes, I did. I apologize, Nick. The Amazon Synod, enculturation was a topic that came up, and a good deal of ink was spilled trying to justify this or that view of enculturation. But enculturation for Catholics is something that goes back to the very beginnings of the Catholic Church, meaning that the church started out as a small group of converted Jews. But it had to come over into Greek and Roman civilization. It had to come into African civilization. It had to come into Asian civilizations all the way, you know, they say even Thomas the Apostle went over to India. So enculturation is not new. It's part of the progress of the gospel and the teachings of the Catholic Church across time and space. But what is an appropriate understanding of enculturation? Again, our number here is 888-318-7884. So if you have questions in that regard, 888-318-7884. And our guest is Dr. Jared Stout. He's the director of formation for the Office of Catholic Schools of the Archdiocese of Denver and teaches for the Augustine Institute there in Denver. He holds a PhD in systematic theology from Ave Maria University in Florida, and he's the author of The Beer Option from Angelico Press. And now he's the editor of a new book, The University and the Church, Don J. Briel's Essays on Education. Dr. Stout, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be with you.
So what is enculturation? How should I just think about that term?
Well, you know, there's a classic phrase that grace builds upon nature and perfects it.
Yes.
And it's the same thing when it comes to culture. Cultures are a shared way of life. And so the faith has to penetrate into that and to heal it and perfect it. And the church uses culture to express the faith.
So can you give us any early examples of enculturation in the early church? Did the church having to use what's available in the culture to transmit the faith?
Well, you mentioned the very first enculturation already into Greco-Roman civilization. And so we see in Acts of the Apostles that enculturation entails finding what's good in the culture and healing and elevating that, but having to really confront what is bad and what's negative. So we see, you know, Paul at the Areopagus, you know, quoting Greek philosophy and poets like Pindar in his speech there. So he's drawing on what is good, Greek philosophy. You look at the Council of Jerusalem. That was addressing, you know, what do we do about these Greek converts, the Gentiles, as they're coming into the church? And so there was a sorting out. You know, the Gentiles do not have to become Jews, right? They don't have to be circumcised. But hey, you know, you can't marry those that are too close of kin. That was considered an example of porneia. And so you can't do that. You can't marry your first cousins and so forth. And you can't be associated with idolatrous worship. So don't eat food that is known to have been sacrificed to idols. And then something that they insisted on then, but we don't any longer, not to eat blood, which was very important for the Jews.
Again, 888-318-7884, in the wake of the Amazon Synod and the various discussions that came around that in regard to enculturation, we have Dr. Jared Stout here to help us work through the Catholic understanding of enculturation. So this idea of getting the gospel to people using the tools that of the local culture, trying to maybe draw out what is good from the local culture and use that as something that can help people accept and live the gospel. Do we have examples of how to do that wrong then?
Well, yeah, there's examples of how to do it right, you know, and as I mentioned, Paul would be a great example of that. But how to do it wrong in some way is to take something that is contrary to the faith itself and to embrace that. So one of the biggest controversies in terms of enculturation had to do with Matteo Ricci. You know, Ricci was affirming Confucius as a good moral teacher, but he also was affirming ancestor worship. And the Vatican condemned that practice, but actually reinstated it in 1939 because it said it's okay to venerate and honor your ancestors as long as you're not worshiping them like God. So that was something that was extremely controversial. But so as the faith is coming into a culture and it's kind of discerning, you know, what can be accepted and what can't be accepted, there's things that flat out contradict the faith and especially the first commandment and the moral life that just have to be rejected.
It's funny when you said that, it also made me think of St. Boniface cutting down the tree that the pagans worshipped. And then I think some people credit Boniface with encouraging the Christmas tree. There's a way in which there are certain things that just can't be tolerated once you've accepted the gospel, and the worship of pagan deities cannot be tolerated, but we like trees.
Yeah. Well, tradition says that Boniface probably actually made a chapel out of that tree. Okay. But you can see there's this recurring image coming out in Germanic culture of using the tree as a religious symbol. Other examples are, you know, other missionaries like Augustine of Canterbury going into Kent in England and turning over idols. But then St. Gregory the Great said, but go ahead and re-consecrate the temples as churches. So right there, you're accepting the architecture that had been used for right. pagan worship, and you're baptizing it.
Yeah, that's interesting because recently in Rome, got to go to some of the very ancient basilica churches. And I mean basilica style, not the way we mean basilica now. And those are Roman buildings, essentially. I mean, of course, there's the Pantheon right there in the heart of it all, which is now a church of Mary. But you see in the basilica style, yeah, that's just basically a Roman building, but they made it into a – we'll use that because it works for our worship.
Yeah, and initially in Rome, they weren't just taking over temples. That did happen over time, like the Pantheon. But the basilica was actually a meeting hall for the emperor. He would come and settle cases. And so it was more of like a public meeting room. And that was a statement that the early church was making in Rome. We're actually not like the pagans. We don't worship like the pagans. We have a different way of coming into the hall of the king and attending to the king. You know, just like people come and attend to the emperor. But yeah, there are certainly examples of reusing pagan architecture.
I have heard it from, actually, I've heard this from a Hindu in one case, but people who have researched Hindu religion and Christian religion saying that for many Hindus, it's very easy to accept Christ as God, that that's not a problem. The problem is that their understanding of what that means is rooted in a Hindu view of the world, which is itself incompatible with the Jewish view of the world.
Yeah, and that brings us to a flashpoint of syncretism.
Okay.
The Romans were actually okay with that as well. Yeah, go ahead and worship Jesus as a God if you want to, but you can only do that within the pantheon of the gods. You have to honor the emperor as a god and burn incense to him. And so, yeah, in the East, you see examples of this as well, of wanting to bring Jesus and Mary into the pantheon of the gods. And obviously the early martyrs died, you know, for their unwillingness to do that.
888-318-7884, our number, Dr. Jared Stout, our guest, and we're talking about enculturation, which is kind of a pressing issue as the church continues to encounter cultures that it has not encountered before, in part because this is what humans do. We create new cultures. And so even the modern world, constantly creating new cultural circumstances and understandings and systems of meaning and all that. And in part because there's a debate within the church about exactly what does this mean, and how much is too much, and where are we accepting things that we should not be accepting, and how much is not too much? How much is an acceptable level of enculturation? 888-318-7884. You mentioned to me before we went on the air another kind of enculturation that went awry among, I believe you said, among the Nordic people. Was that correct? Or?
Yeah, that's right. This is something that I mentioned in the beer option, that, you know, beer was something that was very much a part of the Germanic culture and the Nordic culture. And I'm sure that the rivers and lakes all froze up in Scandinavia. And so the Norwegians were actually baptizing with beer. And the Pope had to put the kibosh on that and said, that is not an appropriate form of enculturation, right? You know, you're in that case, you are damaging the faith because you're changing the matter of the sacrament. So those baptisms would have been invalid. So you can drink the beer, you know, at your baptismal celebration, you know, after, you know, the sacrament is celebrated, but no, yeah, you can't use the beer during.
I think you can drink during in the old Scandinavian cultures. It's just the baby can't be drinking while being baptized.
That's right. Yeah.
Otherwise, you're welcome to have a beer in your hand. So it's like the mega churches today where everybody's drinking coffee while church is going on. So you recently, then we have the Amazon Synod, a synod that really actually is very concerned with this question of enculturation. So questions of, you know, should we have married priests for this area? Questions of how do the various deities or spirits or spiritual practices of the Amazon basin, of which I'm sure there are a great multiplicity, how can those be either kind of brought in under the influence of the gospel, and which are not? You mentioned to me earlier when we were talking about celibacy and the argument that really celibate priesthood doesn't make sense in Amazonian culture, and we shouldn't push celibate priesthood because that won't connect with that culture at all.
Yeah, and there's a great irony there because, you know, as we know, celibacy was not widespread in Jewish culture. And so Jesus coming as a celibate man and presenting himself as the bridegroom of the church is something that would have been jarring. That would have been jarring in Greco-Roman culture. It was certainly jarring in the Germanic culture as they were evangelized in the Middle Ages. And so I can't, you know, just think off the top of my head of a culture that would say, oh, yeah, celibacy. Yeah, no problem. That's easy. You know, we accept that in our culture, right? It's a challenge to every culture. And so when you simply say, well, a certain group of people can't understand celibacy, they don't easily accept celibacy, I think the answer is, well, this is not a cultural issue. This is an issue that stems from our faith, from the life of Christ, and from the nature of the priesthood.
So you got to be willing to be the truth is the gospel and the person of Christ himself, there is a shocking element to both of these realities. And in many ways, they're the same reality, of course. But there is a shock, and we can't just, you know, say, oh, enculturation, like it's a magic word, and get rid of the shock of the gospel and of the person of Christ.
The gospel is a challenge to every culture. And, you know, there's no culture that's like, oh, I'm good. Yeah, I don't need grace. I don't need salvation. There is going to be a woundedness and habits of sin in every single culture. And so there can be this sense, and, you know, we want to overcome colonization, right? I think that was a big deal in the Amazon Synod, right? You know, this is a people who's been colonized, that's been exploited. So we don't want to do that. So instead, we are just going to affirm every single thing about the culture without actually challenging it. Now, what we see in the Amazon, like throughout Latin America, is a period of decline. There's just not as many Catholics in the Amazon region, and they're becoming evangelical and Pentecostal. And I think when we ask why, I think the answer is because those groups are actually challenging them and presenting the faith as something that they have to accept. And we're not doing that as much And so there's even, you know, there were people at the synod who were, you know, even bragging like, oh, I'm not trying to proselytize the natives here. I'm just trying to defend their rights. And then at a certain point, we have to say, well, you're subordinating the mission of the gospel then to this local culture, right? That's not enculturation.
Right. In a certain sense, it's cowardice about the gospel itself. Right. Or just a lukewarmness, at the very least, about the gospel itself. Dr. Jared Stout, our guest, we're talking about enculturation. When we come back, I have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to ask you about Mary and enculturation. As you were speaking, I was thinking about her. Our Lady of Guadalupe, she doesn't look very European. She doesn't look very Jewish. So who is that, Our Lady of Guadalupe? And what might she have to say about enculturation? 888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. It's Cyber Monday. Have you checked out our online sale at shop.catholic.com? Stop by our online shop today, where everything is on sale. Shop.catholic.com.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, recovering from two Thanksgiving dinners. Hope your Thanksgiving was wonderful. Hope your Advent is beginning well, and we'll talk about Advent next hour with another professor, another important figure at the Augustine Institute, Dr. Edward Sri. I didn't know we were having, it didn't occur to me until just now, we're having an all-Augustine Institute day today, which turns out that's a pretty good day when you have an all-Augustine Institute day. Our guest this hour is Dr. Jared Stout, who is an associate professor. Is that the right way to say it? Associate professor at Augustine Institute, along with his duties in the Archdiocese of Denver. So I was mentioning that Our Lady's apparent willingness to be a kind of cultural connection with people. I know a chaplain who comes pretty close to saying that Our Lady is French because she has appeared to the French and spoken to them in French so many times that apparently she has been naturalized there. But what about Our Lady and enculturation? And I mentioned Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Well, you know, I was just at Knock in September, and, you know, that's the only Marian apparition where Our Lady doesn't speak. And the Irish say it's, you know, because she couldn't get a word in edgewise. But
my Irish relatives, they are all proof of that.
Yeah. But Our Lady of Guadalupe is a great example. You know, you see the Franciscan missionaries coming and not having much luck. There really is kind of a class of civilization that comes with the conquistadors, right? I mean, they're conquerors.
Yeah.
But then Our Lady comes and presents herself in a way that really reaches the people. And I think something that's very fascinating is we've now done scientific studies of the tilma, and there are elements that, you know, don't have any pigment. You can't even really see them, you know, in any way kind of being in the fabric. It's almost like they're on top. But then there's other parts that are painted on, right? So some of the Aztec imagery on the tilma seems to have been painted, whether it's by Juan Diego or another. It was very early on because our earliest depictions of it has that imagery on it. So it's a great combination, I would say, of Our Lady reaching out to the culture, and then also whether it was Juan Diego or someone else very early on, even able to use some of the local, you know, forms of dress and the imagery with the stars to enhance the image and make it speak even more to the local culture.
Again, we're talking enculturation. Our number 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. We'll go now to Griffin in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, listening on EWTN Radio. Griffin, your question for Dr. Jared Stout.
Yeah, my question on cultural indoctrination with America and Santa Claus, how do we deal with the fact that like Christmas has become less about worshiping Christ Mass and more about worshiping when, you know, Saint Nick comes and drops presents off to children? Like, how should we reaffirm, I guess, for lack of a better term, the term reason for the season? How do we reaffirm that? Because it seems to sort of be lost. Like, even reason for the season seems to like sort of more affirm Santa Claus than Christ.
Yeah, you see that on other things too as well, though, like Easter and Halloween. These are all religious feasts that come directly. And people, look, Halloween is not a pagan feast that became Christian. It's a Christian feast. It always has been. But this is the case that we're paganizing the Christian symbols instead of Christianizing the pagan symbols. What do we do now?
I think it's a great question because, you know, even beyond Christmas, it's something that always has to be addressed. I mean, just in your own life, right? You accept the gospel, but then you have challenges or you go back to old habits, right? I think it's something we can all relate to. The same thing does happen in a culture. You accept the faith and you're purifying the culture, but things start creeping out. And I think one example of that historically is the Germans going back to a very warlike culture, right? The Germans were great warriors. They were brought to the faith, but they just wanted to fight, right? And so the church created chivalry as a way to try to even harness that, you know, for the good. Okay, but Christmas is obviously a big question. And I would say that there is so much to work with. Even on secular radio stations, you're still playing religious music. And fortunately, Santa Claus is a saint. So we can really try to bring people back to St. Nicholas. Let's talk about his story. Why do we associate Santa Claus with gifts? It's because St. Nicholas was giving gold, you know, through the window to three young ladies so that their father wouldn't sell them into prostitution. He was giving them a dowry. And so there's a great story there. I mean, you can spare some of the little kids the details of that, I suppose.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think there's so much that we can do. Now, Easter Bunny, and that's harder, right? But when it comes to Christmas, we do have many opportunities to draw people back. I mean, this is the birthday of Jesus, and you see images of the manger all around. And Santa Claus is a saint, right? So we just have to really play that up as much as we can.
Okay, Griffin?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, St. Nicholas is a saint, but he also decked out an Arian heretic. I mean, Santa Claus is not St. Nicholas, as far as I know.
Ah, I see. Yeah, right. There's a certain way in which Santa Claus has become a character separate from the person of St. Nicholas.
Yeah, and I think that that's definitely true, right? You know, it's the night before Christmas where you see this, you know, kind of secular legend arising, reindeer and all of that, which doesn't have anything to do with St. Nicholas. But Santa Claus, I mean, does come from Santa Niklaus, right? I mean, so I'm just saying that there's a lot for us to work with there, at least to try to bring it back to the truth.
Griffin, thank you very, very much. Our number 888-318-7884. We're talking about the ongoing and as long as this world persists and the Lord has not yet returned, perpetual kind of negotiation between the church and culture. How do we know when the church is being too accommodating to culture such that it's betraying its own foundations, particularly the person of Jesus? When do we know when it's okay to proceed with finding current cultural expressions that can be used to help people to grasp and to live the gospel. As I said, Dr. Jared Stout, our guest, 888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. I met, you know what, like right now, Kanye West is doing all this gospel music and stuff. And at some point, someone's going to want to play some Kanye at Mass. And even great music doesn't always belong in the Mass. So how do we think about enculturation and the Mass?
Yeah, and I think the Mass is a place where you definitely see this coming out. I mean, language is a key part of enculturation. The Mass in the early church was said in Greek, and it took even a couple hundred years in Rome for it to be said in Latin. And then you see, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, that the church brought Roman civilization along with the Mass to the Germans.
You know what, and Dr. Stout, how about we finish that up on the other side, okay? I apologize.
Absolutely,
I didn't realize I left you so little time. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. The topic is enculturation. Our guest is Dr. Jared Stout, and our number, as always, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Trash Talk.
Words really do hurt. We'll help you deal with the negative, critical people in your life.
And now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour is Dr. Jared Stout. Next hour, Dr. Edward Shree will be with us. And we're going to talk about Advent, and particularly about Christ and his Advent. So bring your questions about Advent and about the one Messiah for next hour. Our number now and then, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. This hour, talking with Dr. Jared Stout about enculturation. If you have questions in that regard, 888-318-7884. So I did a cruel thing and said, explain to me enculturation in the Mass, and apparently there was 23 seconds left. So that's not fair.
Well, I do think that Mass is one of the main places you see enculturation. And when you go back to the early church, right, you see early enculturations into Syriac, into the Armenian culture, Coptic, But when it came to bringing the faith to the Germans and the new barbarian peoples who came into Western Europe after the collapse of Rome, there was something different that happened. It's as if they were being drawn into the culture of the Roman Empire, which the church had accepted in Western Europe. And so they were taught to read and write in Latin, not even in their own Germanic languages. And so they were given the Mass in Latin. And of course, that has came down to us even all the way into the 20th century, where we didn't have this enculturation to all the different particular languages of Western Europe, but that we kept a common sacred language. But Vatican II changed that big time, as we all know. And so I think it's very appropriate even to look at what's happened in the Mass over the last 50 years, as of November 30th, right? 50 years exactly, of the Mass as enculturation. And now we have the enculturation of the Mass into the English language and to all the different languages around the world. And we even know that was somewhat difficult. We had to do a second try, right, on our translation of the Mass into English just in the last few years. And of course, this came up in the Amazon Synod as well. You know, should there be an Amazon rite? The only equivalent that I think that happened since Vatican II is that there's something called the Congolese Zaire Jus, where it's the Roman rite, but in a way that is particular to African culture. So, for instance, they do the penitential rite and sign of peace after the homily. And they do incorporate some African liturgical dance, which is different than some liturgical dance you might see in the United States, and some other particular things like that that they're drawing in from their culture. And so that is something we might see coming out of the Amazon Synod, is a farther enculturation of the Mass drawing upon the different Amazonian cultures. So I think we have to be clear, right, that there's, you know, dozens of even language groups in the Amazon region and over 200 languages, you know, all told. So there's not even one monolithic culture in the Amazon region, which of course makes enculturation all the more difficult there.
So you're saying that this would be perfectly consistent with church history, that you're this is not a problematic thing to say, well, you should have a local rite for the local people in the local language. The problematic thing seems to be the local, as far as the Amazon basin goes, is enormous and varied, tremendously varied. But there's nothing. I mean, as you said, the gospel goes to Egypt, and you get the Mass in the Coptic language, and it's 2,000 years later, and you still have the Mass in the Coptic language, and that never was a Latin Mass. And so this should be seen as normal, not abnormal.
It's a little bit more complicated than that because, you know, what's the normal language in Egypt? It's Arabic. Or if you look at Cyril and Methodius. Yeah, that's my point. But They're still celebrating the liturgy in Coptic.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So they're still using an older sacred language. And you look at Cyril and Methodius, right? They invented the Cyrillic alphabet, translated the Bible into the Slavic languages and the Mass. But no one speaks Church Slavonic any longer. And so you still have this sacred language shared amongst the Slavs. So it's not necessarily that the church will enculturate into every single particular language, but there's been more of a tradition at least of having a sacred language in certain regions.
Yes.
Now, following Vatican II, we do generally have the Mass, the Roman Rite, losing a lot of its Roman character, actually, and becoming more of a local rite, even simply through the use of language. Because once you start translating the Mass and the Bible into the local language, there are difficulties of translation. You know, how do we convey this concept in a different language? Because this word is not exactly like that word.
Right, right. Yeah, so even like, as we spoke about with Hindu people in India before, the word God means something really entirely different. It's almost like you have to invent the word in order to convey the idea.
That's what Matteo Ricci did. Right. You know, Tian Chu, he said the Lord of the Heavens, which was not a normal name for God. He did draw it from the Chinese tradition, but it was so distinct that people said that Christianity was the Tian Chu religion, the Lord of the Heaven religion, because that was something distinctive that he came up with to try to translate the concept of God into Chinese.
And this, we're only dealing with people from Earth. If we meet aliens, this is really going to get complicated.
A whole new level of enculturation there. Yeah.
Yeah, right. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You know, something just occurred to me, the use of wheat in the Eucharist, wheat is not the staple in most of the world, and yet the church never changed on that.
And wine is another example. I mean, going back to Norway, right? You can't grow grapes in Norway. So what do you have to do? You have to import the wine, and it's something that's very expensive. And so that's an important point with enculturation, is that there are certain elements that we can use. So if you look at the stave churches in Norway, you can build very distinctive, beautiful wooden churches there, but you can't substitute Edelberry wine or something like that. You know, it has to be grape wine. You have to import that, you know, from the south.
Yep. Let's go to Janine in Texas listening on, Janie in Texas listening on Guadalupe Record. Guadalupe Radio. Oh, yeah, good. Okay. I maybe had a little too much fun for Thanksgiving. I apologize for that. What line is Janine on? Or Janie on? Oh, two. Okay. Janie, I apologize. Your question for Dr. Stout.
Hi. I just wanted to clarify, because when you spoke about the Blessed Virgin Mary Guadalupe on the Filma of Juan Diego, you said something about it having paint. And from mm-hmm. what I've read and from what I understand, it was a miracle. It was not painted on. And that changes things in my mind. That's not a miracle. Once you find paint on there, it's not. So I would like, if you can, I mean, you're the one with PhD, not me, but if you can provide what source or where is this information? Because mm-hmm. the way
And also, were you denying the miraculous nature of the tilma?
No, not at all. We know exactly what is a miraculous image on the tilma, and we know what's painted on. I've read a number of books about this, so I think you can find a lot of information online. We know exactly where there's paint on the tilma. We even know when it was put on. I mean, there are recent restorations in the last 100 years, 200 years, where and when you look at the image, you can see where that paint is peeling off. The miraculous image of Our Lady's face and hair and eyes and her hands, although the fingers are not distinguishable in the original miraculous image, and her garments, which don't have the decorations on them in the miraculous image, right? So that was all that was imprinted on there miraculously, but the stars, the decorations, the distinctiveness of her fingers, and there is a little bit of paint even on her face, but touching up the face, but not the face itself. There's been very thorough scientific studies, and there are many, many miraculous things about the tilma. But I heard somebody say it this way, is that it is a great example of enculturation, because we have Our Lady coming, presenting us with this image, and yet, because this paint was first put on there very early on, and the angels part of that as well as the paint, is that it's a cooperation then of God and man. Right, so that the image does have things that are contributed from the culture, but the base image is absolutely miraculous and from Our Lady. And I would say that same principle is crucial to enculturation. Enculturation is based upon the Word becoming flesh and using physical means to communicate Himself in the world. And so Christianity seeks to continue this incarnation, right, through the Mass, the sacraments, but also the churches that we build and the art. It's like we're extending the power of the incarnation and the communication of the spiritual through the physical. And a very important contrast is actually Islam. For Islam, the Quran is not translatable. There are secondary translations, but they're not to be used for prayer and worship. And you don't see that same kind of enculturation in the Islamic tradition, where you do see Arabic culture that spreads, you know, with the spread of Islam more strongly. You can still see elements of enculturation, but it's not nearly as strong as Christianity. And I think that's because Christianity is a religion of the incarnation.
I'm glad Janie asked, though, just so that that's clear, that when you say paint is added to the image, it does not mean that the image itself is not a miraculous thing. It is.
That's right.
But people worked on it in subsequent years. And you can find
it. And I know that's shocking to people, because some people think it's 100% miraculous. But when you really even look at it, like I said, you can even see what's painted and what's not, because the paint deteriorates, but the miraculous image doesn't.
Thanks, Janie. We have to, well, you know what? Before we go, yeah, let's take a quick break. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dr. Jared Stout, and we're talking about enculturation. More questions, and if you've got one you'd like to bring to us, we could probably get you on the line, 888-318-7884.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Prayer changes everything. We read in sacred scripture that when we come to God in prayer, He changes our lot. It isn't so much that the circumstances change. It is that we change, and therefore we see the circumstances differently. Prayer does everything for us. It is indeed the air that fills our soul, just as the oxygen fills our lungs. We can't do without prayer. To do without prayer means we languish and we die. God wants us to have life and to have it to the full.
Welcome back. Hey, we all know about Black Friday, Small Business Saturday. Do you know about Saturday? On the Saturday after Black Friday, you're supposed to go to a local small business and patronize them so that you're not just sending all of your money to, what's his name, Jeff Bezos. Because he already has all the money. So spend a little in your... Those have a lot to do with material goods, but don't forget about Giving Tuesday coming up. There's lots of opportunities to give on Giving Tuesday. It's Tuesday, December 3rd. It's a global generosity movement. It's perfect opportunity to support EW10. I'm just going to throw out some stuff. Your local Catholic radio station or network. You can throw a couple shekels towards Catholic Answers if you want. For more information about supporting Catholic Answers, if you want to do it, just go to givecatholic.com. And I know that EW10's got a push going on. I'm pretty sure your local Catholic radio station does. So don't forget to support some Catholic stuff while you're doing your Giving Tuesday things. Givecatholic.com. givecatholic.com. Dr. Jared Stout, our guest. Dr. Stout, we had a caller who wanted to ask a question about enculturation, who did not want to stay on the line. Anonymous caller says this: has there ever been a situation when the culture was too strongly incorporated and altered the truths of the faith?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a classic example, this happened in the Byzantine Empire, is where the emperors were saying, well, divorce was something that's accepted in Roman law. The Byzantine Empire was a continuation of the Roman Empire. And so can we accept divorce? And so in the Orthodox Church, there's a kind of penitential practice that can happen once a marriage breaks down to enable someone to enter into a second marriage. Now, obviously, we're talking about the Amazon Synod. So what was the thing that was so controversial there? Well, can you accept a pagan idol as a symbol of something? It's actually a great question, because Apollo, for instance, has been accepted as a symbol of reason and beauty and nobility.
And even Jesus. Apollo, in the earliest church, in Christian tombs, they sometimes used Apollo with a little bird to show that it wasn't Apollo, but everyone would have known that that this actually represents Jesus.
The catacombs used a number of pagan symbols. However, they were not worshipped as such.
No, right. Right.
And
right.
So you had this, statue of Panchamama, who was actually venerated during the Amazon Synod, right? And it's not simply like a past image, like an historical image, like Apollo might be today, of still some kind of noble image of reason and beauty. Here we're talking about a false god, goddess, right, who is still worshipped. In some places in Latin America, who then is brought into a religious setting, a Catholic setting, and then venerated, right? And so we would say that cannot happen, right? You can't have an enculturation that accepts the worship of any false deity.
Fair enough. I want to offer you a controversial one too, because I just want to. I don't know. There's some ways in which here in the United States, we American Catholics are enculturated to some of the habits of the culture around us. And we even kind of bring those into the church. And they don't belong there. That's it, as much as we want to be loyal to our country and love our country, we should not be accepting, for example, the consumerist nature of contemporary culture. Or, look, I know this makes people angry, but there are have been things that have been done in the course of warfare in American history that as Catholics we should not be celebrating, including destruction of whole cities from the air. And these are not things that we can accept. And if you're doing that, well, and you're mad at people about Pachamama, well, you should be thinking about what have I enculturated into my faith that I shouldn't have.
Yeah, you know, and you asked a question before our second break about music and the liturgy. And of course, the church created her own musical style with Gregorian chant. But with this kind of newer wave of enculturation in the liturgy, there's a lot of experimentation with music. And I think there's a lot of music that we bring into the liturgy, which doesn't have a sacred character to it. You know, some of the tunes and melodies just seem a bit too upbeat. Sometimes they sound like, you know, Broadway, you know, musical melodies.
Some of them actually come from Broadway musicals. There's
right.
Yeah.
Or you had mentioned it even about pop music coming in, right? And there are some instances of that, right? So that would be an attempt to enculturate American culture into the church. And there are certainly ways in which we see that happening.
888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. Let me see who is up next here for Dr. Stout. Alfredo in Oklahoma City, you are up next. Your question for Dr. Stout.
Yes, good evening. My question is, who, why, where, when was it determined that December the 25th would be the day that we would celebrate our Lord's birthday? And I'll get off the phone and let you answer.
I bet our answers will differ, so I'm going to let you do this one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is something that does come up on Catholic Answers often, right? But
I think there's two
main theories.
Yeah.
One is that March 25th was an earlier date, the date of the incarnation and the date of the crucifixion. There was a tradition in the early church that they happened on the same calendar day, March 25th. Then thinking that a pregnancy is roughly 9 months, that the church got to December 25th. Another thing is that December 25th was actually the winter solstice day in the ancient world. Now it's December 21st. So Jesus' birthday was the winter solstice day. It was a day in many pagan cultures of honoring the sun. But as we know, in the early church, we celebrated Mass. Everyone was facing east towards the rising sun. And so the sun itself was even a symbol of Christ and his resurrection. And so it wasn't seen as an inappropriate enculturation to really own that day. You know, and it is the time of the year in which the days start getting longer. So there was this tradition with John the Baptist, right? I must decrease, he must increase. So June 24th was the summer solstice day. So from John the Baptist's birthday, the days decrease, and from Jesus' birthday, the days increase. Some people want to associate, you know, December 25th with the cult of Mithras, but I was even reading about this recently, that actually caught on December 25th after it was already the birth day of Jesus.
So we didn't end up disagreeing at all, really. In my view, I personally just add one thing to that, and that is Jesus was born on that day. But other than that, I think we completely agree. I just happen to think that. That's my own personal opinion, though. The church doesn't teach that. But all everything you said makes sense. How does that strike you, Alfredo? No?
That was great. Thank you very much for the answer.
Very, very good.
Thank you. You're welcome.
The answer that is not probably very convincing, and I knew you were not going to get, is that it's a pagan holiday that Christians stole. There seems to be no historical evidence of that.
Yes, but as I mentioned, the winter solstice was a day that had a lot of religious significance for many cultures. So I'll just say that.
Yes. Okay. Certainly, without question. But okay, fair enough. Let's go to David in Orlando, Florida next. David, your question for Dr. Jared Stout.
Doctor, I noticed that you had referred to America's passed, I think, in war.
That was me.
A bombing of whole cities.
Yeah, that was...
It seemed to me that you might have been referring to Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
And again, I have to say that was not Dr. Stout who said that.
That's okay. I have written about this topic. I have an article on Catholic World Report that you can look up. So I'm happy with taking this question myself.
Okay, go ahead, caller.
Okay, so my question is, it seems that, at least in my understanding of the events of the war, that the United States faced a decision to end the war by an invasion of Japan, which would most certainly have resulted in casualties many, many times greater than the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that the decision was made to drop those two bombs to end the war. And so I guess I would ask your thoughts about that.
Yeah. I think there's a number of important things to consider. One is that according to Catholic teaching, the end never justifies the means. So it's very clear that Truman and our military leadership had good intentions by wanting to save casualties on both sides. But a good intention does not mean that you can use unjust means to accomplish that good intention. And so the church teaches, you can see this in Gaudium et Spes, the church's document on the church in the modern world from Vatican II, that the indiscriminate killing of civilians is always wrong. Now, Hiroshima was considered to be a military target. There was a number of bases associated with the city and a large number of military personnel. So you could make a better case for justifying Hiroshima. Nagasaki was not a military target. It did have industry, which was practiced there in support of the war, but it was a solely civilian target. And so I don't see that there's any way to justify that as a target. And by the way, it was the bomb was accidentally dropped on the Catholic neighborhood of Urukami and Nagasaki,
which was the largest Catholic community in Asia at the time.
Right. Well, outside of the Philippines, right? But
Right. Sir. Right.
So I think that it's not that nuclear weapons per se cannot be used, but they cannot be used in a way that indiscriminately kills civilians. I think that that's as a clear principle of the church's teaching. And there were a lot of other political considerations. So the line that the newspapers gave is not the only line. There were other considerations such as keeping the Russians out of Japan. And that's part of our decision to use nuclear weapons at that exact moment. So anyway, it is a very complex discussion, but those are just some things to think about.
David, I'm going to say thank you very, very much for the call. We're talking about the problems of enculturation. And among them is this, and maybe we see that more now. I don't know if we see it more now than in history, but there's the thing about enculturation, but then there's accommodation, an overly accommodating the person who either you want to invite into the church and you want to make that very easy for the person, or accommodating a culture in which you don't want to be criticized. As a Catholic body, you just keep your mouth shut because you don't want to be criticized about something that the culture has done.
I think it's a good point. I mean, there's one practice even in the Amazon region that dates back, you know, many centuries, and that's exposing children after birth. And so that came up very briefly in the Amazon Synod, and that is something that we would 100% have to reject. And there was a particular bishop who was a missionary bishop in Brazil who just tried to dismiss that as not being a big deal, right? And I think that could be an example of the accommodation that you're talking about. So John Paul, I think, is the Pope of culture and the Pope of enculturation, and he was very confident and the church's ability to renew cultures and even to build new cultures. Because really, that is what we need right now, even in the West, is we need the same kind of energy that we had after the collapse of the Roman Empire to build a new Christian culture. But he also said, and in Redemptoris Missio is where you can see his teaching on enculturation very clearly, is that there is a risk. And so he said, and I can even quote him, he said, we must in no way compromise the distinctiveness and integrity of the Christian faith. So he recognized that there is a danger, right? So there's a great possibility, but we also have to be cautious.
Dr. Jared Stout, it's always a great pleasure to have you here. You know what? I forgot to mention you got a pilgrimage coming up. Your pilgrimages always include beer. So because you're the you're the author of the beer option, just so people know, where can they go to find out about your upcoming pilgrimage?
Yeah, it's the Vine and the Cloister. So it's a wine focus this coming September, the last week of September. And the information will be posted this week on rtijourneys.com. So Religious Travel International, rtijourneys.com.
I feel like you're a traitor to beer now. Thank you very much, Dr. Stout. Up next, another member of the Augustine Institute family, Dr. Edward Sree, will be with us. And we're going to talk about the advent of Christ right after this.